This is HeartWise, offering practical tips and time-proven guidelines to make your life healthier, happier, and more fulfilling. Today you'll learn simple Bible-based principles for building and maintaining optimum mental and physical health, all while deepening your relationship with your Creator. I'm your HeartWise host, Charles Mills. You know the old saying, it's a dirty job, but someone has to do it? That's my take on health professionals who help us care for our colon and rectal system. But I thank God every day that these people exist, and one of them happens to be our guest today. Eric Nelson is a colon and rectal surgery doctor practicing in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and he's an expert in colorectal diseases of the most unpleasant and dangerous kind. This is a busy man. How busy, you say? Well, he's on his cell phone in his car waiting to go to yet another appointment today. That's how busy he is. Dr. Nelson, welcome to HeartWise.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Of all the specialties you could go into as a surgeon, why colorectal? What drew you to that?
Well, I really love helping people, and it turns out that the specific diseases that I treat, almost all of them, are very treatable and in most cases curable. And that makes the patients happy and that makes me happy. The other reason that I find it especially fascinating is that a vast majority of the diseases that I treat are very lifestyle related. And so not only are they treatable with, you know, surgery and medications when necessary, but many of them are preventable. And I like to tell patients that, you know, I might need to operate on them, but maybe if they make some of the changes I'm recommending, their children will not need an operation.
Wow. Are you including Crohn's disease in this?
Crohn's disease is certainly partly lifestyle related, but a big component of it is genetics, the environment, toxin exposure. We're not sure exactly what causes Crohn's disease in any specific person, but yes, there's one randomized controlled trial demonstrating very nicely that once Crohn's disease has been treated with surgery, the recurrence can be put off at least for probably years with a specific diet.
Dr. Nelson, if you could go into everybody's house right now and just go into their kitchen, because you say it's a lot of the diet related, and yank out something and throw it away, what would it be that would help our colons and our rectums?
The thing that got the most press recently, I guess it's been about a year ago now, the World Health Organization classified processed meats on the same level as cigarettes as far as their cancer-causing ability. Now, that doesn't mean that they cause cancer as often as cigarettes do, but they're certainly just as dangerous. And these particular products, for whatever reason, specifically cause a lot of colon and rectal cancer. Certainly red meats and especially grilled meats are especially dangerous as well. They're classified one level below that as from cigarettes. So that would be a good start. I also tell my patients they really need to cut back on their intake of processed foods, not necessarily because these directly cause cancer, but certainly obesity is a risk factor for cancer, and not only a risk factor for cancer, but those patients who do get cancer do worse if they're obese than those who are not obese.
Wow.
So certainly processed foods are contributing to that. Sugary beverages, energy drinks. I tell my patients they need to drink only water. And then, of course, everyone needs to exercise more, and exercise has been shown to be protective. It decreases the risk of colon cancer.
Well, Dr. Nelson, what you just said would basically empty out most people's cupboards. If you do that, if you take out the processed meats and the processed foods and all of these things you mentioned, what would you put in its place? What are things that will actually help our colon and help our rectal systems that we're not eating?
Well, everybody, of course, needs more fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say there's any magic bullet, any one specific food that everyone needs to eat, right. But in general, eating foods as grown, lots of complex carbohydrates from whole grains. Beans are certainly helpful because they're very high in fiber. And in general, a high-fiber diet from beans, bran cereal, fruits, vegetables, these foods in general are protective for colon cancer. And there's a variety of reasons why. They somewhat ameliorate the effects of any toxins that might get into the colon.
Mm-hmm.
They help the stool be more formed, more soft, and pass through more quickly. And in addition to being protective for cancer, they're very protective for a variety of other diseases as well. Hmm.
Dr. Nelson, what is it about processed meats and sugary drinks and all the things you mentioned that are on the do not eat list? What is it about these things that cause the problem in the colon and in the rectum? What portion of them is the most dangerous?
I don't think anyone has figured out exactly what that one portion is. Otherwise, you would see a lot of people in the stores advertising that their meat has had that one thing deleted.
That's true.
I don't think it's one thing. Yeah. Although certainly when meats are grilled, there are a lot of nitrosamines, which are nitrate products that we know are cancer-causing that are developed. So cooking meat at very high temperature, especially with the blood, is very detrimental. Mm-hmm. I think part of it has to do with the fact that all of these things I just mentioned, as you mentioned, tend to go together in the standard American diet.
True, true.
And that is, they're very concentrated calories, which in turn tend to lead to obesity. The fact that they're low in fiber may play a role in that whatever toxins are there are in contact with the colon's lining or the mucosa for longer periods of time. As far as the sugary drinks go, again, I think it comes down to the calories. And in all of these different food products that we buy in grocery stores that are processed and sit on the shelves for a long time, it may be that there is some change to the bacteria in the colon. You've heard of the gut microbiome.
Yes. Yes.
This is the collection of the thousands of different types of bacteria that live in the colon and can be very helpful or can be very harmful depending on what we feed them. What I know is that there's a lot of people trying to push various products to adjust your gut microbiome. Mm-hmm. You've heard of probiotics,
sure,
and prebiotics, etc.
Sure. Yeah.
Now, these are helpful in certain specific cases, but in general, the science is not there yet. We don't know exactly which bacteria are helpful and harmful. We don't have that information yet. What we do know is that what you eat drastically affects the balance of bacteria in your colon. And this in some way is related. We just don't exactly understand how yet.
We're talking with Dr. Eric Nelson. He is a colon and rectal surgery doctor practicing in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Dr. Nelson, can we get in an airplane and go someplace in this world where colons and rectal systems are healthier than ours and then look at their diet? Will that be helpful at all?
Certainly, Dr. Burkitt, so many years ago, went to Africa and discovered that Africans didn't get diverticulitis the way Americans did, and he started the idea that a high-fiber diet was protective against diverticulitis. And certainly there is a certain amount of truth to that. We now know there's some additional factors as well, but certainly that's the basis of all the good advice that we give our patients about with diverticulitis, that they need to be eating a high-fiber diet. Probably some of your listeners have heard the idea that if someone has diverticula, these are the little outpouchings off the colon that frequently develop as we get older.
Mm-hmm.
If someone has those, they should avoid eating seeds and nuts and popcorn and berries that have the small seeds. It turns out that information is not only false, but the opposite is true.
Mm-hmm.
All of those foods I just listed are very high in fiber, and there's been at least 3 randomized controlled trials showing that people who do eat a diet heavy in those things did better as far as their diverticulitis goes. And so that's one of those old wives' fables that turns out to be a myth, but nevertheless, some doctors still believe it and tell their patients that.
Oh,
but
boy.
It turns out the opposite is true. You want to eat a high-fiber diet, and even those nuts and seeds and berries and popcorn, those foods, it turns out, are healthy for folks with diverticulitis.
Let's talk just for a moment here about fecal incontinence. I mean, I cannot think of a more troubling situation to be in. How can you help us there?
Fecal incontinence is a lot more common than most people think. It turns out that up to 7, maybe even 8% of women who have had a child, in the United States anyway, will develop fecal incontinence. Perhaps in other areas, the rates are even higher if they don't have access to good gynecologic care. And the reasons for that are multifactorial. Certainly having a baby can be traumatic to the sphincter muscles. It can be traumatic for the pelvic floor. There can be some tearing of some of these muscles. Even if none of that tearing happens, though, the nerve that go to the muscles that help someone maintain their fecal continence can be stretched simply by carrying a child, even if they're delivered by cesarean section.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So fecal incontinence is very common in women. It's less common in men. There are other causes, though, that certainly can affect both genders. Certain types of back trauma, spinal cord injury, certainly trauma to the anus, all of these things can cause fecal incontinence. One of the more troubling statistics to me is that of patients in nursing homes right now, somewhere around 40 to 50% of those patients are in the nursing home because of fecal incontinence. Mm. That doesn't mean that that's their only medical issue, but it means that their family could keep them at home, but they finally couldn't deal with the fecal incontinence, and so they put them in a nursing home. I think it's about $8 billion is spent in this country every year on adult diapers. Mm. So this is a big problem, and it's a very common problem, one that many people seem to simply suffer in silence. And so I'd encourage any of your listeners who do have problems with fecal incontinence to seek treatment. Let's talk about the definition of fecal incontinence
right.
a little bit.
Yes.
The definition of fecal incontinence is the inability to control gas or stool. Mm. So some people, not only, you know, they can control stool, but they have difficulty controlling gas or flatus. So this is very embarrassing to them, and it sometimes keeps them at home. It keeps them from going out, and that's just as disabling as someone else who, you know, has control issues with their stool.
Are you saying it can be helped? You can help it by surgery? Is there hope?
There's definitely hope. The first thing we always try is what's simple, cheap, and easy, and that certainly is not surgery. The first thing to do is simply wear pads or wear diapers. Mm-hmm. And if someone is, you know, elderly and in a nursing home, maybe that's all they need. That would be the first step. The second step would be a high-fiber diet again. I think you'll sense a theme here, and your listeners will sense a theme. Pretty much everything I treat is helped by a high-fiber diet.
Yes, yes.
And fecal incontinence is no exception. If someone is able to get 30 to 35 grams of fiber a day if they're a woman and 40 grams of fiber if they're a man, this amount of fiber will enable the stools to be formed. And it's a lot easier to control formed stool than liquid stool. Mm-hmm. That would be the second step. The third step would be practicing Kegel exercises. Many women are familiar with Kegel exercises. It consists of squeezing the muscles of the pelvic floor. These are the muscles that give control over stool as well as urine. Squeezing them as hard as one can and holding it for 3 seconds and then relaxing. Hmm. I recommend that any of my patients with fecal incontinence start working on Kegel exercises at least 10 times every morning, 10 times every evening. It's just like weightlifting for your bottom. So this will strengthen the muscles of the pelvic floor, strengthen the ability to hold stool just a little bit longer. And those three things alone may be all that's required for treating fecal incontinence. With fecal incontinence, there are certain medications that can be helpful to slow down the passage of stool and give a little bit more strength to the muscles of the pelvic floor. If conservative medical treatment, medications are not helpful, the next step would be referral to a colorectal surgeon for some pelvic floor testing. This testing is not painful, but it will help the surgeon figure out, is the problem with the sensory nerves that are going to the bottom, the motor nerves that are going to the bottom, the internal anal sphincter, the external anal sphincter, the capacity of the rectum to hold stool, or is there any anatomic factors such as hemorrhoids that are causing the fecal incontinence? Mm-hmm. After that complete examination, the patient can be given a recommendation on what specific surgical treatments might be an option to help the patient with their fecal incontinence.
Well, what about the opposite of that, the opposite of fecal incontinence? How about constipation? Is there help for that too?
Again, very commonly people suffer in silence.
Right.
Many women especially have trouble not stooling very frequently. Constipation is defined by the frequency of stool and the, shall we say, the consistency of the stool. Mm-hmm. People can have harder stools or they can have difficulty evacuating their stools. And constipation, it turns out, there are multiple different factors that can play a role here. Again, the treatment for constipation would start with the simple, cheap, and easy things such as fiber and water. Mm-hmm. I also recommend my patients walk for at least 10 or 15 minutes after every meal. This can sometimes stimulate the colon to move. Maybe some of your listeners are familiar with the importance of stooling correctly. That is, when one sits on the toilet to have a bowel movement, it's important to be in the squatting position. Mm-hmm. Because this straightens out the what's called the anorectal angle and allows the stool to slide out a little bit more easily. One thing I would also say about constipation, try not to worry about it too much. And a lot of people, the more they worry about their bowel movements, the worse it gets.
That's true. That's true. So
the next stage of treatment, of course, would be medications. And I would encourage listeners not to take stimulant laxatives. These laxatives, over time, stop working and the colon kind of burns out and doesn't work anymore. So stimulant laxatives would include things such as Ducalax, Senna, and pretty much any of the, quote, natural laxatives that you can buy at a drugstore will include the herb Senna. And certainly it works short-term to stimulate the colon, but long-term it is very detrimental. I would encourage your listeners, if they do need a laxative, to use an osmotic laxative such as Miralax or any of the generics of the polyethylene glycol. These are not absorbed by the body. They're completely safe. You can take more than one or two or even three or four doses at a time, and they're very effective if you keep increasing the dose until you get to the point that it appears to be working for you appropriately.
We're talking with Dr. Eric Nelson. He is a colon and rectal surgery doctor practicing in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We'll take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about cancer of the colon and the screening and prevention and treatment of that. Very important information coming along, so everybody stay right where you are.
I'm Dr. James Markham, and here's your biblical prescription for life. Have you ever longed for a different prescription, one without dangerous side effects? Everyone is concerned, or should be concerned, about side effects or adverse reactions when taking a medication. Well, today I want to explain to you what a biblical prescription is. Let's turn to James 1:5. This is our biblical prescription for today. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given to him. Well, a biblical prescription is all about asking God for wisdom. Wisdom from the scriptures to prevent and treat disease. The Bible applies to all aspects of life. In our biblical prescription for life segments, I will point out scripture, show the evidence-based science behind the scripture, and how this scripture chemically changes us. For more information, I want you to go to our website. That's heartwiseministries.org.
HeartWise with Charles Mills is brought to you by supporters of HeartWise Ministries. We are so grateful to be able to follow Christ's example of caring for others' physical needs and then encouraging them to experience a restorative relationship with our Heavenly Father. God intended for life on earth to be immeasurably better than the world we live in today, and He wants to restore His vision for this world one heart at a time. Consider becoming a HeartWise partner and help others catch the vision of what Christ wants to do in their hearts today by visiting us online at heartwiseministries.org.
Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Charles Mills. Our guest today, Dr. Eric Nelson. He is a colon and rectal surgery doctor practicing in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He's in his car talking on his cell phone, getting ready to go someplace. He's not driving. He's sitting there in the parking lot, but he is so busy we caught him between hospitals. And Dr. Nelson, this sort of tells us that anything that's going to keep you this busy is a problem that we're having in our society. Let's talk about colon cancer here. I see a lot of screening programs out there to help people find out what's wrong with their colons. Do these things actually work, these screening programs?
Yes, they definitely work, and they're incredibly important. Of course, we previously talked on your program about how diet can be very helpful in preventing colon cancer. Yes. But diet is not 100% protective for colon cancer. The reason colon cancer is so common is the cells that line the colon, which are called the mucosal cells, are rapidly dividing. Anytime you have that many cells lining your entire colon, which is about 5 or 6 feet long, dividing very rapidly, some of them may turn into cancer. And although your body can fight them off in the early stages, eventually some of them might slip through. The risk of someone getting colon cancer in the United States is probably about 1 in 20. I tell my patients that with a very healthy diet and exercise, they can probably decrease the chances to about 1 in 30 to 1 in 35. So, of course, that's very helpful, but we still need to do screening, preferably with a colonoscopy, to detect colon cancer while it's in the very early stages. There are some other screening modalities that your listeners are probably aware of. Some of the simplest, which are also helpful, are simply taking a little card home. Sometimes your doctor will send it to you in the mail, and you put some of your stool on it and mail it back in. These are testing for blood in the stool, and if it comes up positive, you will need a colonoscopy. If it comes back negative, we can be relatively assured that you don't have cancer. The reason I prefer colonoscopy is that it doesn't have to be done quite as frequently. If someone is at normal risk for colon cancer and their colonoscopy is completely clear, they don't need another one for 10 years.
Okay.
Whereas putting some poop on a card, you need to do that every year.
That's the
screening modality you choose.
Okay.
The other advantage of colonoscopy is it is not only diagnostic, but therapeutic.
Hmm.
That means not only would you find colon cancer, hopefully in an early stage, but you can prevent colon cancer by removing the precancerous polyps that develop in the colon wall. These polyps usually take anywhere from, 3 to 10 years to turn into cancer. And by removing them, you can prevent cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I prefer colonoscopy as the screening modality of choice.
And for those people who unfortunately have colon cancer, what treatment works best for them?
Well, it depends on what stages. If someone unfortunately is found to have colon or rectal cancer, their gastroenterologist or colorectal surgeon will likely order CT scans and a lab test, at least initially. Some patients with rectal cancer will also need MRIs or advanced tests. Once these tests have been done, your doctor will tell you what stage your cancer is.
Mm-hmm.
Stage 1 and stage 2 colon cancer is typically treated with surgery alone, and this should be curative. That's why, again, I chose colon and rectal surgery, because I like curing folks.
Yes.
If someone does have stage 3 colon cancer, that indicates that the cancer has already spread to the lymph node.
Mm.
In these cases, surgery would still be needed. However, someone would also, in those cases, need chemotherapy because there are likely microscopic cancer cells floating around the body that have not yet implanted somewhere, such as the liver or lungs, and started to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And the chemotherapy can decrease, although not eliminate, the risk that the patient will develop colon cancer metastases in the future. If someone has stage 4 colon cancer, this indicates the cancer has already spread to some other organ, whether the liver, the lungs, less likely the bones or the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Almost always, the colon cancer spreads first to the liver, and even some of these stage 4 colon cancers can be cured with a combination of surgery, chemotherapy, and in some cases, targeted radiation therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say even up to 30-35% of patients with isolated metastatic colon cancer can be cured by a combination of different therapies. Obviously, that depends on where it's spread to, how widely it's spread, and a number of other factors. But that gives me a lot of hope
because
it wasn't but 10, 15 years ago that these patients were kind of given up as a lost cause.
Yeah.
But now we know that we can cure some of them with a combination of different therapies.
Well, you've outlined beautifully on this interview here the power of what God put in place in our diet and exercise and et cetera, but also the power of modern medicine to help when we're beyond the help of those things. I guess what I'm hearing you say is there is hope no matter where you happen to be on this journey. Am I right in saying that?
There's always hope, and certainly goals of care may be different depending on where someone is at and how old they are and what their wishes are.
Mm.
But there's always hope, and I would encourage folks to, if they're not feeling a lot of hope, to get a second opinion. And most doctors are not offended if someone wants to get additional opinions to find out what all of their options are.
Dr. Eric Nelson, he is a colon and rectal surgery doctor practicing in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Thank you so much for these words of wisdom and guidance.
All right. God bless.
And listener, until next time, this is Charles Mills along with Dr. Nelson inviting you to remain heartwise. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for joining us today on HeartWise. If you'd like more information on how to build and maintain optimum physical, mental, and spiritual health, log on to heartwiseministries.org. HeartWise is a listener-supported program, and your partnership with us would be greatly appreciated. Once again, our web address is heartwiseministries.org.